Should all acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should all acquaintance be forgot for the sake of all anxiety? For all anxiety, my dear, for all anxiety, we'll take
Hey everybody, so this podcast episode was recorded over 3 months ago. It still remains relevant because we're talking about some awesome movies, and so I'm sorry that I didn't get it out till now. Also, the intro that we recorded because it was late is already probably almost a month late itself. So again, this is me being lazy slash busy slash whatever. But I hope you really enjoy this episode. It's our first of the year, and we'll be back in the next week or so with a new episode featuring Blaine, myself, and Blaine's brother talking about Star Wars ripoff films that we like, including my selection, The Insatiable Thirst for Bo Nerjuice, which is loosely a Star Wars ripoff, and mostly a weird, gross-out poop and dick movie. So, that should be interesting. We hope that you enjoy that episode and this episode, and we hope you enjoy all the episodes, because we certainly enjoy spending time recording them and putting them out for you guys. Lots of big announcements coming for the Farsighted Network. So there'll be some rebranding and some new stuff going on, but we're excited to be part of the network, and excited for some of the new additions coming to the network, and that's really about it. Before I say for the 15th time, I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to our previously recorded intro to our even more previously recorded podcast. Thanks, everybody, and I'll see you in a week.
Niggas fighting over reigns, niggas won't be the king, but long live the chief. For a little old thing, little boys bang bang. Long live the chief. Niggas fighting over reigns, niggas won't be the king, but long live the chief. Yeah, watch pretty mama while I slay my cane. Long live the chief. Cockroaches in the ratchet. Hand-me-downs with the patches. Mama put a little money in the mattress. Taught me how to make a silver spoon out of plastic. You can either sink, swim, or be the captain. Get the last word, I'ma get the last laugh.
Right, now they say you've been around the dress so classic. I don't want my best dress day in the casket. All right. You can either leave.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Grindhouse Messiah, the podcast where I usually make Blaine kick things off because it makes me feel better about myself. But I'll be the fool to fuck up in the beginning first. How's that sound?
That sounds like a good plan. Just to let everybody know, I think this is the first time in our 14, 15 episodes that we didn't take like six takes just to say welcome back to a show.
There might be something about that. There might be someone who's a little better at it than someone else. I'm just saying.
Hey, that said, I'm Blaine, and I'm back, and I'm not first.
I love you, Blaine. So everybody, thanks for coming back. We want to start off today by just saying that we recorded an episode last week that was supposed to be coming out this week with two wonderful ladies, Brittany, pronounce her last name for me, Blaine, you're better at it.
Filardo.
Brittany Filardo and Stephanie Estes of a film called Alter, a found footage film that just came out a few months ago. I believe it's available on pretty much every streaming platform, and we'll have links for both of them and for the movie in this podcast, so you can check that out. But unfortunately, due to some technical difficulties, we lost that episode, and we're going to go get these ladies back. We're hoping about the beginning of January or so.
Absolutely, man. I can't wait to have them back. We had a really good discussion. We got to talk a lot about, you know, found footage films and their experiences working. So, man, they're so cool about it also. We cannot wait to get those ladies back. And they're super talented. So make sure to check out all their stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So definitely check them out. Check out the movie Alter. And check out their other stuff, too. They were a blast to talk to. And honestly, you know, I guess it could happen. It could be worse because we could have had to talk to somebody who was really shitty again. And this time we had to talk to somebody who was really cool. So that's okay.
Yeah, and we've really lucked out so far, you know, with the guests we've had. And every guest just gets better than the last one because luckily we've had a good run.
We really have. So thanks to you guys for sticking with us. The episode that you're going to hear in just a few minutes is actually, it was recorded, almost 2 months ago now. And why has it not gone up, Blaine?
Because you're a lazy bitch, man.
Totally true.
We had a nearly hour and a half conversation with the director and star and writer of the wonderful movie released this year, Union Furnace. Super great. Check it out. We're going to talk more about it here in a few minutes. But they took the time out of their day, and what did you do with it?
It seems like I just wiped my ass with it, but I didn't. It's still here, and you're going to hear proof that I didn't just lose that content. It's actually a fantastic episode, and it's definitely a movie that I want you guys to hear about that I might have actually downplayed its brutality a little bit, but it is a really brutal movie, but a lot of the brutality actually takes place off screen. But it's still like a heart-wrenching, you know, rip-out-your-guts kind of movie in a lot of ways. So really great flick, and we'll talk briefly about that a little bit more before we hand it over. But before we do that, Blaine, I think we have to do a little bit of housekeeping. There's a certain organization who puts out really awesome films who has sponsored us.
Yes.
Who's that?
This organization is a group you may hear me talk about ad nauseum. If you follow me on Twitter, you know that's mainly what I talk about. It is the wonderful folks over at Vinegar Syndrome who sent us over a whopping, five discs with six movies for the month of October. These were all actual, like, certified bangers in my book. So I want to just hop right into the first three that I want to talk about really briefly because we have, you know, plans for it moving in the future. These are the work, some, you know, selected works of the great female director Roberta Findlay, who, I have to be honest, I didn't know very much about outside of her horrible movie Snuff, which I know both of us share a pretty strong dislike for. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I won't say I hate the film. I'll just say it's not good.
I will.
Like, we briefly mentioned that film and Roberta in the last episode when we were talking with Adriana, because she's a huge Vinegar Syndrome fan as well. Snuff is not a good movie. And on top of it already being not a good movie, they tacked on some bullshit ending to make it look like it was a real snuff film. And that bullshit ending is more bullshit than ending. It's just a piece of crap. So if you take that away, it's probably just as bad a movie, but at least it's not gimmicky as fuck. Not a fan of that film. However, in light of the fact that we have three more Roberta Findlay movies in front of us, I'm intrigued to maybe even give that a rewatch. Maybe not. But we're going to definitely do an episode on her and her films sometime between now and March. And I think we're really looking for a voice of someone who knows more about her that could be our guest. So if you're that person, please give us a shout out. You can hit us up on Twitter at Grindhouse Messiah. Is it that Grindhouse Messiah? No, it's at Grind Messiah. It's at Grindhouse Messiah on Instagram. I'm just fucking things up all over the place. But hit us up over there or either one of us. You can see all of our contact info in the show notes today. So definitely hit us up if you're that person who can talk about Roberta Findlay. But what were those three movies that came in the pack, Wayne?
Yeah, the three movies that came in the pack was A Woman's Torment, which was a single disc release.
Really? And if you happen to grab that movie, keep in mind there's two versions of that film on the disc as well, right?
There are, and the go-to on there is a hardcore version that is pretty...
When you say hardcore, are you talking about, like, the punk rock music?
No, I'm discussing pornography.
Oh, okay, you're talking about, like, the old in-out, in-out.
The old in-out, in-out, and pop. So, yeah, but as much as I make jokes about it, it was a movie that is... It's maybe not the best film out of the bunch, but it is such a strange movie. It's kind of like a porno play on Repulsion or a lot of, you know, kind of similar films where you have a woman who's, you know, clearly lost her mind and she's unraveling in kind of a single space. But it's a really interesting watch. It's not great, but it's more interesting than anything else.
Well, and there's also a version without the hardcore scenes on the disc, right?
There is one. I have not got a chance to watch that version yet. I'm kind of curious to
see. Oh, yeah, because I'm real surprised that you chose the hardcore version to play.
Well, I honestly didn't know there was...
I know that.
But yeah, no, I eventually will get around because I kind of want to see what it's like with maybe a few more minutes trimmed off, you know.
Well, I'm intrigued to know, and maybe this is something that if it was... do you know if it was originally filmed as a hardcore and then cut down, or if the hardcore is added in?
Well, apparently it seems like it was hardcore. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't stunt people or anything like that.
Okay, because I've seen, you know, they call her One Eye or Thriller or whatever you want to call it, and there's like 10 names for that movie. A Cruel Picture. That particular film, the hardcore version was all add-ins.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, rewatching, you know, without that, I could see how it was a much better film without the add-ins, but... So I was just curious because I know that some films did that in order to get play, because sometimes getting distribution at the smut theaters was actually easier for films that were exploitation.
Oh yeah, and this isn't one of those kind of movies where I don't think with the hardcore or without it, it's going to be much of a different movie. It's not like Sinful Dwarf or, like you said, Thriller. But it's standalone. It's a really interesting thing, especially for the lack of experience I've had with her films. The other disc, which is a double, it comes with a movie called Prime Evil, as well as another bonus movie called Lurkers. These were both, I mean, I gotta say, these are really, really interesting movies. Prime Evil, which is the main film on here, is basically about a strange going-ons at a New York monastery where... like these weird...
Sorry about the car starting in my ear.
I'll just start back over right there.
All right.
Yeah, Prime Evil is basically about a bunch of strange going-ons over at a downtown New York City monastery, which I didn't know they had, but... you know, with a bunch of satanic priests, they're trying to bring the devil back and whatnot. It's got really fun kills... bizarre dialogue and then a...
You didn't know that existed in New York, huh?
Hey, what do I know? I'm just a country...
I grew up near New York, and I'll tell you, that's just called Tuesday.
Okay, well, hey, I'm trying to get hip with you kids. So, the bonus film is Lurkers, which is a really cool, violent kind of ghost story where a girl, her father kills her mother. She goes back to the house. There's these vengeful spirits. Things get fucked up. Lots of fun, like I said before, I don't want to go into these too much because I really think these three movies would make for a really great discussion, and I just want to learn everything about Roberta Findlay, watch all of her movies, and because I'm totally in love with her now. So, but
so the other two films, right? I'll talk about one because I only got to watch one. Oh, there's three more. Shit. Well, the other of the three films, I've only watched one of them. One of them being Corpse Grinders. If you're not familiar with the film, I feel like it's kind of an exploitation classic in a lot of ways. I mean, I feel like everybody I know who's into like horror and exploitation of like that has probably seen a version of this film. I guess it's not public domain per se, but it seems like it's on like every freaking streaming thing that there is. I'm not the biggest fan of it, and I only got a chance to watch the DVD, and you told me that the Blu-ray looks fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is one of those movies I have similar experience where I've seen it here and there. I wasn't really hot or cold on it. I was just like, it's one of those movies. But I mean, this new 4K scan actually makes the film, to me, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I mean,
you told me you actually think it's a better film.
Well, much better, because all the prints I've ever seen were really murky, hard to see, especially at all the night scenes when they're going in and out of. Yeah, because basically it's about, you know, a cat food company that falls on hard times and starts grinding up people and selling those as food, and some scientists that are out to, you know, crack the code on it. But yeah, it looks so much better. I had kind of a new appreciation because I was actually turning it on while I was doing stuff around the house, and it found myself just sitting on the couch and just watching the movie. And yeah, I mean, I think if you're a fan of the movie or if you haven't seen it for a long time, this is definitely the best way to see it. And it's also kind of nice with, you know, remembering the passing of Ted Mikkels this year, you know, kind of honoring him with one of his most well-known films. So, yeah, no, it's definitely interesting.
And so of the other two films, I'm forgetting what one of them is. So what, besides Demon Wind, what was the other one?
The other one is Bloodbeat, which is something.
Oh my God! I remember now why I forgot.
Yeah, I've only been talking. I'm not the biggest fan. Yeah, I've only been talking about this movie for, I don't know, the past 3 or 4 months. This is a film I have never seen. I've always came across it in lists of, you know, kind of lost cult classics, and I was not disappointed. As soon as I opened my mail, I saw it. I ran inside, tore it out of its case, threw it on. And ended up watching it like 2.5 times because it's just so weird. It's such a weird movie. It's basically like a little supernatural slasher. It's kind of I believe it was a French and U.S. co-production, and it's like this art house version of like a regional slasher, but the main slasher is like a disembodied samurai suit with a sword that chops up people, and there's like lots of weird sexiness.
It's one of those movies to me that sounds like the concept might be better than the actual film.
I don't know. Okay. I really liked it.
I will admit that I haven't gotten through it yet. So
yeah.
It's one that I have sitting in a pile, and it's below several others. Maybe I do need to bump it up to the top, and you know, we'll see. But there's one more film in this pack. And this one you seriously haven't stopped raving about since the moment you put it on.
No, it's...
So tell me about... This is your favorite of the pack, right?
By far, my favorite out of the pack. A movie that I saw a very long time ago, and it was a complete piece of shit, you know, copy, and I didn't even make it all the way through. This is Demon Wind, which is known for having the most awesome cover ever with... This like super.
It basically is the most awesome cover ever. It really is.
It's like a super like awesome like drawing of this demon guy popping through a bedroom door or window, and that heads up. Demon's not in the movie, but what is in the movie is like a completely batshit version of Evil Dead. Basically, it ends up, you know, it's like
Evil Dead by way of Fulci. I feel like you said
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of Fulci. Like, it even has the kind of that dream logic everybody likes to talk about in the film, where, you know, you kind of don't know what's real, what's in their heads, and it follows a guy named Corey, who his grandparents were these, you know, devil worshiping blah blah blahs, and ends up he's having all these weird dreams. He connects with his mother, and then basically a group of him and his friends go out to this cabin where his folks used to live. And things go, like, completely batshit crazy. Like, when I say they go crazy, there's so much weird stuff packed into, like, 82 minutes. So, yeah, out of the bunch, I mean, really, this and also Blood.
So this is one you're relatively certain that we're going to have to revisit for the podcast.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to keep bugging you about it until we actually cover it in long form. Okay. Because
it will happen. It will happen. Who's the director of Demon Wind? Do you remember?
Demon Wind, yeah. It is a guy. He only did a couple of movies. His name is Charles Philip Moore. And what's interesting about the story...
Roy Moore? This, Roy Moore made movies?
No, Charles Philip Moore.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said Roy Moore. I didn't like... No, I'm just fucking around.
Okay, I was like, well, what's going on? What is this? But yeah, no, it's one of those weird stories where it was a group that was making, you know, low budget but semi-successful VHS films. And this one of the guys working on their crew was like, hey, I got an idea for a horror movie. And apparently the company was very unhappy with what he turned in because it ended up being this just absolutely batshit crazy, Evil Dead ripoff. But, yeah.
Well, and if there's one thing that Vinegar Syndrome does best, it's finding batshit crazy stuff.
Right.
And that's one of the best things. Like, I'll be the first to admit that, like, I don't always love everything as far as the film, but, man, everything that they do to preserve these films is incredible. And, like, you know, you look at these prints, that's amazing. And then they put on really freaking awesome features of, like, weird lost interviews and things. And it's just awesome that somebody puts this kind of care in. And, like, you know, obviously Vinegar Syndrome is not the only people doing this. But there aren't a lot of people picking up the batshit stuff that they do. You know, outside of them, on a smaller scale, people like Garage House and Harry Garrow, there's nobody that's going quite as deep as these people. And I'll have to say, man, kudos, as always. And we appreciate them both as a sponsor and just as fans.
Oh, absolutely. And what I think is so awesome about what they're doing is they're literally bringing back that movie store kind of curation where they make you feel like, okay, I just got six movies. I've seen maybe one of them or two of them, 10, 15 years ago. And they're just like, and they're bringing just this like sense of discovery back where these days.
Well, it's so cool how they do the packs. You know, if you're new to this, one of the cool things, like you're saying, maybe you only know one or two of them. The coolest way to buy them, if you have, the money to spend on some movies, and we encourage you to do so, obviously, because they sponsor us and they're awesome, is to buy their monthly packs. Their monthly packs give you a hefty discount on the actual sticker price if you buy all of them together.
Yeah, and then you got 3 to 5 movies delivered to your house that you may or may not have ever heard of, and I guarantee they're all going to be interesting, and one or two of them you're going to love.
Right, exactly. And so thanks again to Vinegar Syndrome. I just want to plug, I'm really excited for their next pack. Their November pack has shipped out to some folks and not to everybody yet because they had a really crazy successful Black Friday sale where they are still playing catch up with their orders because it was just insane. Like the site's actually down as we speak because of it. And so those 3 movies, I can tell you, I'm so excited for. I've been wanting to see Liquid Sky for a long time. Never seen it. Very excited about it. And it seems like it's one of the most anticipated titles from any boutique label in a while because they sold that out so fucking quickly with their, they sold out their limited edition run with the special covers, I think within a couple hours of the sale starting. In addition to that, titles that I didn't know they were putting out, they did actually kind of announce them as they put them for sale, one of them being Disconnected, which you said is a film, who's the director of that?
It's the same guy who did Psychos in Love, which I don't
know. Right, and they just put out – Psychos in Love just put out that a couple months ago, a title we talked about a couple episodes ago. And then the one that I'm really stoked on is a movie I rented at least a dozen times in college on VHS from the local Blockbuster because there was nowhere to buy it at the time. We just kept renting it. We tried to convince the guy to sell it to us, called The Ice Cream Man, starring Clint Howard. And let me tell you, this movie's not a good movie, but it's fucking great. and like films like Corpse Grinders and all these other films where, people are forced to make people eat people and such, it's not exactly a brand new concept. But it's got Clint Howard, it's got cannibalism, and it's got ice cream. I'm not sure if there's anything else you need.
No, and I have never seen this movie, so I'm excited to take in three of my favorite things all at once, and hopefully we'll be getting around to those. Those titles here in the next couple of weeks.
And if I can just note the fact, as a reminder, if you're a new new podcast listener, when I was in college, I was at a Christian college, so we played this as loud as we possibly could with the door open in our dorm room, often to just fuck with the other kids. So it was pretty great. And interestingly enough, the guy that used to rent it with me all the time, super like hardcore conservative, but he just loved horror movies. So it was a real good time. But yeah, so with that, thanks again to Vinegar Syndrome. Very excited to have them sponsoring the podcast. And now let's jump into the episode that we've been wanting to share with you guys for the 2 months that I was a lazy asshole. And just once again remind you that this is about the movie Union Furnace. This is the director and writer/star of the film. They were really fun to talk to. I'm sure we're going to talk to them again. They have other projects in the works, one of which we're probably going to be reviewing for the site in the near future. So definitely check out their links for their Twitter and their accounts in the show notes. Support the folks that from Alter, you know, Stephanie and Brittany. And thanks again for sticking with us.
All right. Now, here's the episode.
It doesn't sound right unless you say peace.
Peace. All right, folks. See you next time.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Grindhouse Messiah. This is Justin and my co-host.
This is Blaine again.
And we're here today to talk about a movie called Union Furnace and another movie that the fellas here selected for us to watch. But before we introduce them, I just want to thank our sponsor, Vinegar Syndrome. Got their new releases sitting on my desk, and I'm excited to dive into those, and we'll be talking about those real soon. So stay tuned to upcoming episodes so we can talk about all the awesome stuff they're doing, and thanks to them for sponsoring the podcast. So with that, let me start with some introductions to our guests. I have Nick and Mike. Nick, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Nicholas Bushman. I am the co-writer and director of Union Furnace.
And Mike?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm Mike Dwyer. I am the co-writer, the producer, and co-star of the movie as well, Union Furnace. Glad to be here.
Awesome, guys. Thanks so much for coming by. And I hadn't heard much about your film initially. But thankfully, I am on the right PR publicity list, and it showed up in my email, and I got a chance to check it out, and I really loved it. And
okay,
it was great, and I liked movies that do a lot with a little, and that's why I felt like you guys, you know, obviously had some budgetary constraints, but you made them work really well, and I like that kind of thing. So kudos to you for sure. And
thanks very much.
Awesome. And why don't you tell us just a little bit about what the film's about, and we'll get more into it later, but just to introduce it to the listeners.
Sure. Well, it's about a car thief played by Mike here in the God-fearing town of Union Furnace, and he gets involved with the mysterious gentleman played by the great Seth Hammond, who asked him to play a series of underground games of life and death. And that's sort of the jumping off point of where it all goes. That's the quick synopsis anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a great synopsis. And with that in mind, just out of curiosity, are you guys from Ohio?
We are, yeah. Yeah, both of us.
Born and bred.
Is Union Furnace a real town? Or?
It is a real town in Ohio, but we just like the name of it. So.
Yeah, I'm hoping that shit's not really happening there. I mean, we don't know, but
it's not. We have to say it's not.
that is a very convincing looking like VFW in any shitty small town.
There you go. Yeah, shot all over Ohio actually, and it kind of seemed like we shot everywhere except the actual town of Union Furnace, where we just
that's kind of hilarious.
Have you been able to show the film in Union Furnace yet to see what the locals think of it?
No. Fair question. No, not yet. I'm Union Furnace is it's in southeastern Ohio in the Hocking Hills. It's a very, very small town. There's probably less than 1,000 people that live in the proper, you know, Union Furnace. No, they haven't reached out to us yet. So
we'd be happy to.
Sure. I don't know how happy they would be with it, but you know.
I thought it was going to be playing the Union Furnace International Film Festival pretty soon. You know.
There you go.
That's awesome, though. I think that the name of the town is incredible, so I get why you would go with that. It's a really awesome name.
Oh, we actually, I mean, we've been saying for years and years before we made it, like, that's such a cool town name. We got to call the movie Union Furnace sometime. And when we had this idea for the story, we were like, boom, that's it. That's the Union Furnace movie. The town is named Union Furnace. So.
Well, and I'm excited to talk a little bit more in depth about that film. But before we get there, I also asked you guys to pick another movie that you thought was one of your influences that we could talk about, too. So kind of want to start with that one and then roll into yours. So what did you guys pick for us?
We picked the amazing Sydney Pollack film from 1969, They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
And I will say that both of us were new to this film. Neither of us had seen it before.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, that's great.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great movies from 1969, you know, it's one of the movies that people don't remember from that year. People remember the movies like Easy Rider or Midnight Cowboy or The Wild Bunch, but They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Was another film of 69. So it's a really, you know, kind of movie that people have forgotten about. So it's nice to, you know, get it back out there.
Yeah, it's one of the great movies. What'd you guys think of it?
I really liked it. Maybe that's like the wrong word. I didn't like it. I felt like horribly depressed by watching it. But that's
phenomenal. Yeah.
I think that what got me about that film really was just the fact that like it feels like such an MGM 60s film, and yet it's got a lot of darkness. You know,
yeah.
It's really, really dark underneath it all, and and just, you know, it's I can see how it's probably one of the first films in the American lexicon to really tackle that. What would you do for money if you're that hard up?
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And obviously that being a theme that a lot of people have written with, in especially in like the horror and exploitation genres that we love, you know. You know, in recent years, I've seen things like, you know, Cheap Thrills. Or the other thing, and I definitely see how that trope kind of might have started right there in 1969.
Right.
If not started there, it certainly grew there. You know, there might be something before it that I'm not aware of, but you know what I mean? And I think it's really awesome to see that spark of where something like that starts. And you know, setting it in like kind of Depression era, which obviously everybody was hard up for money. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, you know.
The film is based on a novel written in 1935. So the movie was written at the height of the Depression. And interestingly enough, actually, Charlie Chaplin was the first person to option the novel to be made into a film. And he planned on making it one of his films. But, of course, he left the country in 1952, and McCarthy did his thing, and then Chaplin was not allowed back in the country. So
right.
The rights of the novel kind of elapsed, and in the mid-1960s, they were bought up by the studio, and then Pollack came along to, you know, a couple of rewrites later, Pollack got involved with the project and made that, you know, basically his first well-known film.
Right.
I mean, this was Sidney Pollack's first big-name movie, and, you know, what I love about that movie so much is that, you know, outside of, you know, Romero's Night of the Living Dead in 68, it kind of feels like a zombie movie because, like you just said, it's not exactly a feel-good picture. And at the end of the movie, people they feel dead inside, and they're, you know, like the living dead after they have to go through this kind of realistic slog to win a little piece of money. And I thought it was a pretty interesting thing that I've always loved about that picture.
Oh yeah, and this was my first time ever, you know, seeing it as well. And I was surprised because when I was looking through, I was like, I couldn't believe that there was a Sidney Pollack movie during that era that I hadn't seen, because I've always been a big fan of, like, Jeremiah Johnson, the Scalp Hunters, you know, Castle Keep, even the Yakuza. And I was like, holy shit. Yeah, there's, like, this big gap in there. And when I checked it out, I ended up getting almost more wrapped up in all that backstory that you were just discussing with Charlie Chaplin. Of course, Gig Johnson going on to, you know, win the Oscar and then, you know, have a murder-suicide with him and his fifth wife. Yeah. You know, I mean, just so much, like, so much Hollywood lore kind of packed into this one little movie. And then, you know, not to, you know, I hate to say beat a dead horse, but...
well done.
Yeah, that year of 1969, you can see just that whole transition coming out of, like, the studio, you know, like, big pictures, lots of bright musicals, these big set pieces, but also this new emerging kind of, like, I don't know, more auteur kind of filmmaking, kind of clashing. And, no, I was really excited. I'm glad you guys picked this, because this is a huge blind spot that I didn't even know that I had.
Oh, cool. It's a Sidney Pollack horror movie, if ever there was one. I think people associate him with, like, you know, a little more like The Way We Were and Tootsie, which I love Tootsie. But, you know, it's the darkest thing he ever did, I think. I mean.
Oh, certainly.
It's got to be one of the darkest things that Jane Fonda was ever involved with, too, right? I mean.
Right.
I think of her as, you know, like, God, everything I think of her is bright and shiny. And then I'm like, damn.
Oh, yeah. Well, and what's interesting talking about, like, 1969 is that you've got both Fondas. You've got Peter doing Easy Ride. And her doing this, and that they're both kind of kickstarting the whole new Hollywood thing.
Yeah, and actually both of them being extremely influential to, like, kind of that exploitation and horror world, really. I mean,
which
we obviously, that's kind of our baby. That's kind of where we Blade and I, you know, are really big into that stuff, obviously. And, you know, with a title like Grindhouse Messiah of our podcast, I think Grindhouse is something that, you know, matters to us. So, you know, it's interesting is that it's a big Hollywood film with, it's got that grindy feel. And, one of the things I found really interesting about the film as well, and I think it's something that I would say, I saw in your film as well, is that a lot of the stuff, that happens as far as it doesn't show a ton. I mean, like, what I mean is, like, horror isn't in what you're watching. It's in what that means and what's behind what you're watching. You know, I mean, you in your film, when we get to it, you know, a lot of the worst stuff kind of happens off screen. You know, and I think that kind of is the case here, too. I mean, it's not really off screen necessarily as much as just, like, in my mind.
Right. You know, that's kind of what we wanted to go for. We definitely... I mean, there's two things at play there in terms of Union Furnace, in that we had very little money to make it. So the more we could leave to your imagination, the better, because there were a lot of things we wanted to do that we couldn't do. But I think that actually ended up working to our advantage. And
I mean, I think everyone's seen everything on screen. I think at this point, shock value is, you know, I love shock value. Don't get me wrong. But I think, I think there's a,
and
I
we mean, got we got some shocking things in there.
Sure.
Yeah, it's that we don't go that bad with it. but I think respecting the audience and to think, you know, with the great viewers that we have this day, and to leave something up to the imagination is something, if you can pull it off, is a really kind of great thing to explore. And just like you said, they shoot horses, don't they? I think it does the same thing, hopefully.
And we'd actually done pieces of stuff in our film that did take things a little further that worked, but it just seemed that there were certain, like, little tiny instances when I was cutting it, and we were just like, no, let's not show that part. Let's just leave it to them. Leave it to you guys.
And I think that, like, you know, to be completely transparent, sorry, Blade, I'm going to out you. He wanted your film to go a little further. Blade is a depraved asshole. So no, I'm just kidding. But in all seriousness, like, but I think it depends on the moviegoer. Like, I think some people like some of that out there stuff. I tend to be someone who doesn't always love shock value in my films. So I think that's why. While we both liked it, I think I vibed with it a little bit more than Blaine, for that reason.
Sure. I mean, you guys act like...
Now that I outed you, Blaine, why don't you have any comment on that?
Oh, no, I mean...
Answer that.
It's like, would you like to defend yourself? No, I mean, for me, like, I think especially when I'm watching independent cinema and things like that, I always like when they push it a little further. It's a lot of it's just the 13-year-old in me that's still hoping that 35 I can still be shocked. I think a lot of that comes from there. But I mean, matching, but like when you describe like why you're avoiding something, it does make sense because you get some really great gore gags in the movie that do satisfy, but there's one scene in there that I am when we get to the movie I gotta ask because it's been driving me nuts for the past couple days. But yeah, no, I do understand that when you are working with things, it's like do you put that time in this movie? Do you drag it out? Add more? More violence, or do you just keep moving at a good pace? And I think where I may have wanted to see a little bit more in some of those scenes, it makes up for it in keeping a good pace, which is going to ultimately be more important, especially when it comes to selling the movie and getting more people to pick it up and watch it. So I definitely understand why. I'm just a fucking teenager in my brain.
I feel you. There's another thing at play too, where we were really trying to show the movie almost entirely from Mike's character's perspective. So that kind of dictated a lot of what we did and didn't show in that did Cody see it or not.
Sure.
Right. To a point, but obviously I think I know where you're going with what's happening with one of the kids. Yeah, we'll get there.
I've been calling it the Twister scene. Is what I've been calling it.
Oh, yes. That's it. They're just playing Twister.
That's what I told my girlfriend. I said, just playing Twister.
That's it. Yeah. It's as depraved or not as you want it to be.
Right.
Well, and so, just to get back onto horses a little bit, one of the things that with horses that I said maybe for me might have been tough is that I felt like the pacing was a little bit choppy at times. Like it was a little too slow for me at points. Not overall, but I felt like there's probably about 10 minutes I could cut out of that movie, maybe 15, to get it moving a little bit better for me, for my tastes. But but that doesn't mean I didn't like it, like I said. But I will say the part of that film. So they shoot horses, don't they? I don't think we have any kind of synopsizing. I think I jumped right into it. So for those listening who happen not to have seen it and are all completely lost in everything we're saying, I'll backtrack and just say, basically, this is, as we mentioned a few times already, it was Depression era. It was written in the Depression, about the Depression era. And basically, all these people who are completely hard up for money are joining this dance marathon. And basically, the winner, winning couple, gets $1,500, which in the 30s is like, God, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so, for them, this is like, getting a year's salary or something. I mean, this is huge. And all these people are out of work. All these people are, in the early scenes when they're trying to sign up. They're all talking about how they haven't had a meal in however long and all this other stuff. So, to them, it's like, oh, wow, we're going to get fed. I just want to join so I can get fed, and so for these folks, they're so hard up, they're going to do this dance marathon. Dance marathon sounds all well and good, right? Like, woohoo, we're going to dance. Except, like, after a couple days, it gets brutal. People are literally collapsing, and then it drags on for how many days does it drag on for?
50. Yeah.
Yeah. 50 freaking days. So, yeah. 50 days of dancing, and the only thing you get in between are little, like, off your feet nap breaks. And you just get back up and do it. And then it's crazy. It's just crazy. These people are dancing the whole time, and they're falling over. You're losing people throughout. But for me, where the movie really just went from kind of a little dark to, oh, fuck, was when was when they literally raced them around like horses.
Yeah.
For 10 minutes straight, and just said, "Oh, the last three couples left are out." And
yeah.
Holy shit! It's literally a horse race, and people are falling, and they're breaking bones, and they're freaking, oh my god! And
dying.
I'm just like, this is awful. Yeah, people died. Yes, yeah. Died during that scene. So yeah, it's awful. And that's the yeah. scene that where it all kind of started to coalesce for me.
Yeah, and, yeah. I mean, and they really did that. These competitions really existed during the Depression. I mean, these people, it's based on I don't think the movie's based on an actual thing, but these you know, Victorian freak show things during the 30s were a real thing in America.
That's true, yeah.
You know, so that's what makes it more terrifying. It's like, oh, my God, it's not fiction. My God, this is a real thing they used to do.
Uh-huh.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Nonfiction is scarier than fiction in our world. The world, you know, everything that we think we can come up with, somebody did it worse. And, and that's the creepy thing about that whole thing. And I mean, you know, you have, for those who haven't seen the movie again, the big thing, you know, you're doing this in like a big arena with tons of people watching and people sponsoring certain couples, and you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And I just love how it's kind of this weird mix of highbrow with kind of trashy fun, as they're like these rich folk putting out their money and watching this, these people who are these poor little peasants out there, you know.
Sure.
They're what? Dirt for them, you know. They're horses. They're horses. That's exactly yeah. what they are.
Well, sure, I think it's important to note, too, that the film takes place in Los Angeles. I mean, the whole competition takes place in Santa Monica, so you have a lot of, you got a lot of actors that went out to Hollywood to, yeah, I want to be a bit next, you know, the next big star, and it's the Depression. Well, I didn't get the role, so.
Mervyn LeRoy's here.
You know, to try and make this thing big, so it's, you know, these people right. that come from Kansas or, you know, Chicago, where Michael Sarrazin comes from in the picture. And they fall back on this thing. Hey, well, if I don't win it, at least I can be discovered and I can be famous. You know, which is always fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And they keep announcing the celebrities who are in the crowd.
Exactly.
Be like, oh, you know, one of the best filmmakers in Hollywood is here tonight.
Exactly.
He's not
exactly.
there scouting talent. He's there watching the peasant dance for him.
That's
yeah.
right.
And it's to them, it's you're right. They have these illusions of grandeur. And at a certain point, those illusions are crushed. And,
yeah.
and some of them, they're crushed by actual death. Sometimes it's by inner death. You know, your soul's crushed and dead, died. I mean, and then obviously, you know, the film, all of a sudden, you start to realize that he's the main character is telling his story from a jail cell. And that changes the whole tone, because now you have this element of, you know, mystery as to why the fuck is this guy in jail telling this story. And of course it ends with a pretty big blow that I'll just leave at that, because it's kind of, if you haven't seen it, you gotta see that, because that puts the whole movie in context.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. The payoff is phenomenal.
Oh yeah.
It really is.
And that use of flash forward is kind of what separates that movie from just being kind of your standard studio pick when it comes to just sense of like kind of style. And I love that use of flash forward, because you're just watching a dance contest, and then you start getting that feeling that things are going to get way, way shittier, you know, and relatively quickly. Because, yeah, because at first I was like, okay, it's a dance contest. Why is this so dark? You know, like, when's the darkness going to happen? And I started seeing those flashes. I'm like, oh, okay. And even though that's something that's not, you know, it's not groundbreaking in 2017, I think in 1969, out of a big budget studio pick, that's fucking huge.
Yeah, people weren't doing stuff like that back then.
I mean, outside of the French playing around with structure and time, and there wasn't a lot of people doing that. I mean,
in America anyway,
certainly.
They were just starting to.
Yeah, you were just getting like people like Hitchcock and stuff that was mimicking that French movement and bringing over, like, you know, stuff like 400 Blows. But we weren't like, it wasn't something that we were just like, oh, this is how, you know, structure works. It does a lot of cool stuff in just sense of just filmmaking in general.
Oh, certainly. You know, and a great piece of trivia about this picture is that to this day, it still holds a record. The movie was nominated for 9 Academy Awards, which, you know, like it or, you know, or leave it, that doesn't matter.
but it was nominated for 9 Academy Awards and was not nominated for Best Picture, which holds that record today. It only won one. Gig Young won Best Actor, but Best Supporting Actor, rather. But no other movie has more Academy Award nominations without being the Best Picture.
Huh.
Which is interesting.
I didn't know
that. That is interesting. It was a relatively big budget film for its time. I'm looking here at $4.86 million in 69. I mean, yeah, it's a pretty big budget.
And it ended up doing $13 million, too.
Yeah.
It lost to Midnight Cowboy. I mean, if you're going to lose to any movie, Midnight Cowboy is a pretty good one to lose to, you know.
Right. What else? Butch Cassidy?
Butch Cassidy, Z, Costa Grava Z was nominated.
Oh, man.
He also had The Wild Bunch. I mean, it's crazy.
Hell yeah.
And just to give the idea, like, kind of the tone of the shifting Hollywood, you got to think what won the year before, which is shocking. It's, you know, fucking Oliver. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Oliver. Oh, you know, my God.
The Carol Reed, musical. It shows just that jump. Right. It's just, that's such a huge jump in just art in itself, where you're going from these, like, very traditional, like, you know, you've got Oliver, you know, a G-rated musical that's, you know, appealing to everyone from like 6-year-olds to 90-year-olds to, you know, Midnight Cowboy.
That'd be a great double feature, Oliver and Midnight Cowboy.
Wow. That's an interesting one. I don't know. That might make Midnight Cowboy so much more shocking, because if you juxtapose it with, wow. I might actually have to have that night one night where I watch those two films back to back. Oh, jeez. Well, so they issue Horse of Dove Day. I definitely see how it was an influence to your film, for sure. And so we transition to talking more about your film. You know, before I tell you what I saw, what were some of the things about that film that you felt were extremely influential to you guys when putting together your film?
Good question. In terms of stuff that was influential, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, there was a structural thing to begin with.
Right.
Just in terms of games versus in-between games. And that movie has only, you know, I mean, it's kind of a two-location movie. Or a one-location movie with two different sets, basically. The back room and then the main arena. And for Union Furnace, we were trying to find something that we could do immediately and cheaply. When we wrote it initially, we wrote it really fast. And the idea of a series of games in a single location was exciting, because it's one location, so you've got that from like an independent still making low budget standpoint. But then at the same time, it's going to be inherently very visual because of the games they're playing. So you're in one location. It's My Dinner with Andre in one location, but they're playing all these crazy ass games. So,
yeah,
the way they accomplished that and just trying to riff on that in our own way. And then there's the Gig Young character, who was a major, major thing for the Lion, for Seth's character, the Lion.
Right.
You know,
the showman that's kind of running the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. The MC. And, you know, Seth could speak to this more than
us. Yeah, yes, he could.
Like, my first thing I said to Seth was, watch They Shoot Horses Don't They right away, when I gave him the script.
another one, you know, another picture that really kind of was bleeding into what we're doing was Pasolini's Sallow, which I don't know if your listeners have seen this picture, but, you know, Piero Pasolini, Sallow, you know, was made in, like, 75.
75, yeah.
He was actually murdered before it came out. It's a unbelievably disturbing film, based somewhat on a real thing that happened in Italy during World War II, which, I don't know, was when I saw it when I was 19 or 20, just seared into my brain. And I guess for whatever reason, when we were coming up with the script, it was like, hey, we'll just watch Sallow. It's Friday night, you know? Hey, like,
we were in a dark place.
Yeah.
I don't think I've never had that thought. Hey, it's Friday night, I'm just gonna pop in Sallow.
It's a good wine, you know.
Yeah. On a side note, I remember it was probably like 2000-2001. I finally got like a shitty bootleg of Sallow in the mail, and I made all my roommates, like my girlfriend at the time, her sister, I was like, family movie night.
Oh man!
Everyone was so mad at me. It was.
We
had a bunch of pizza pockets and shit.
That's the best way to show that movie to somebody.
It's like,
hey, come on over. I got a really fun little movie we should watch.
Right. I'm going to make pizza pockets.
I made a bunch of pizza pockets. I had some Diet Dr. Pepper. I was like, let's have a party.
Oh, man. Well, and I've never seen so. Not that I won't. I'm sure I will. I'm sure this podcast
should
lead to that. But with that in mind, I know its reputation. I know... If I'm correct, it's based on the exploits of the Marquis de Sade, is it not?
Yeah, the 120 Days of Sodom.
Kinda.
Having read some of the Marquis de Sade's writings before, which I kind of regret too, you know, I have enough of an idea to say I get where the influence would come in, having seen your film. So yeah.
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 But you know. To end the Salah conversation, it's not a nihilistic film. I mean, I think the movie, while disturbing as it is, there's actual, you know, there's a horror element to it, you know, based on the reality, which is what we're talking about here. But the movie actually isn't, you know, it's exploitation, but there's a, I don't want to call it a heart, but I don't know what the hell it is.
I don't know what the hell that movie is. It's grounded. It feels so real when you're watching Salah,
which is part of probably why so many people are extra disturbed by it. Because if it wasn't grounded, it would probably be like, oh yeah, it doesn't feel real.
Yeah.
You know?
I tell you to watch it, but I can't tell anybody to actually watch it. See it if you want. No. Don't want to.
I can promise you my wife won't watch it. I'll go there. So if I watch it, it will be alone. That's for but I think that makes sense. So, you know, with those who haven't seen Salo know all you need to really know is it's a film about torture for, what do you call it, sexual gratification?
It's fascism. So, it's a movie about fascism.
Yeah, it's about fascism.
Okay, it's a movie about fascism. We'll just go
and
with that.
And
fascism
was killed before it came out. It's like...
They didn't even finish it. Someone else had to cut it. It was murder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fucking fascist fan.
Yeah. That's right, dude.
And we just recorded another episode that'll be out just before this one comes out about, you know, killing Nazis. Movies about killing Nazis. So it kind
of... Oh, yeah.
kind of works out. There you go. Killing Nazis, fucking fascists. There we go.
Right.
So your film, right, obviously you kind of just hit the nail on the head with some of the stuff that I was thinking too, as far as the influence of Issue Horses is the actual the way you did the film, as far as the layout of it and the time, what you were saying with like the two settings. You know, that are really kind of one setting, but the front stage, backstage, if you will. And that was kind of the whole way yours was too. And I get how from a budget standpoint it makes sense, but it also really, really works for what you did. I mean, so it's not just a budget thing, you know. I can't imagine there being any other settings that would, you know, it doesn't make sense to have any other places in there, you know. The game show doesn't work the same way if you're traveling from place to place or something like that.
That's the trick. You got to find an idea that really works for your limitations, basically.
Right.
That's obvious, but you know, we didn't feel like we were losing anything by the means with which we were doing it. If that makes sense.
Right.
It's also nice to have a kind of a home base in a movie like that, where you're introducing new games and new events, but you're still in the same location, and it also kind of makes everything outside seem a little bit more mysterious and scary of what it's like, you know, of where you are, who's out there. And no, I think that really works well for what you're doing, because there are those low budget movies where you're switching locations all the time. They're trying to use these locations, but eventually you just feel like, okay, you're just going from someone's house to someone's house.
Right.
And I'd rather see just one venue that every single time, as long as you're introducing new shit for us to see, there's, I mean, I think it kind of creates a great, you know, kind of feeling of home once you return to those set pieces.
Yeah, well, we tried to play on that in terms of, like, that we tried to hop around a lot at the very beginning. So you're seeing, like, lots of different locations and really getting kind of an epic take on this crazy small town. And then all of a sudden, the bag goes over Cody's head and you're thrust into the movie. And, you know, it's like, are we going to be here for the rest of the movie?
Yeah, it's like a bunch of people being sentenced to, you know, life without parole. So, you know, the perspective at that point, when you're in jail, the only perspective you have is jail. You don't even, a lot of times you don't have an outside glimpse of the world. So when you're there, why cut to the place that, you know, you can't see? It didn't make a lot of sense. You know, we talked right. about it, but it's like, you know, like, what the hell? Like, let's keep these fucking people in purgatory, you know, like purgatory sucks. So
yeah, that was actually a key to us writing the script. Cause when we first had the idea, and this was all over like a two and a half week period from first idea to finished screenplay, it happened really fast. But the first concept was that it was 7 nights, 7 games. And it did not work at all. Had the whole little opening, and then we're like, set, you know, and then yeah. So they were getting released each day, and we're like, this doesn't work. And then it's like, no, 7 games, 1 night, and then we were able to crank it out in like, you know,
yeah,
less than 2 weeks from then.
Well, yeah, and you're you're saying. When you said purgatory, I automatically jumped. I said, so it's just like Lost. You're actually in purgatory the whole time.
I guess I should probably see Lost at this point.
I've actually never seen it either. I just hear the jokes that people make about, you know, stuff. So no, I've actually never seen it either. I watched the first episode and was like, eh, I'm good.
Actually, my AD on the set kept making Lost references when we were shooting. He's like, that one guy's kind of like that one guy on Lost. I'm like, I've never fucking seen Lost.
What the hell is Lost?
I like a lot of the actors in Lost because I like them in other stuff.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Right.
Oh, and speaking of actors, so that's what drew me to the initial thing, right? Is I get this, you know, from a PR person, I get your PR... you know, about this movie, and I say, Keith fucking David!
Yeah.
I didn't even read the rest of everything. I saw Keith David, and I was like, I want to review this. And so Keith David alone got me in. I mean, you guys kept me involved with Aaron the Bells, but man, how was it working with him?
Amazing.
Yeah, it was great, because, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people that have a little bit of money and they get a name, they get a name actor like Keith, and they bring him for a day or two. So he's just a day player. So what was great is to get Keith in the picture for multiple days and be an integral part of the story, which is very exciting. And I'll let Nick tell you how it got him.
Sure. well, back to those crazy 2 weeks when we were writing it. And Mike and I were just kind of acting out all the different parts. And there's that line in the first, like, green room scene where they're in the back room between games when everybody kind of meets everybody. And the big guy, Jim from Kentucky, walks up to player number one and he goes, I'm Jim. And then player number one goes, I'm Shy. And I was like, that's a Keith fucking David line. It's got to be Keith David.
I go, you're never going to fucking get Keith David.
And I said, you watch me get him. So, but we were writing it, and we were going to go right into shooting it. Because we were in kind of a unique position where we had the money. Mike funded basically the entire film, so we knew that we were going to make it right away. So we were writing as fast as we could, and we had a start date. That was quickly approaching. So I sent it to Keith's people and didn't hear anything back right away. And then we were like 2 weeks away from shooting. And his manager's like, hey, he loves it. Yeah, he wants to talk to you. So I talked to him and I was like, you need to be in Ohio in like 2.5 weeks, man. And he's like, I'll be there. So,
and then you got the child, you got Childs from the thing. I mean, it's.
Yeah, and it was, there's also the whole, you know, massive John Carpenter thing vibe that, you know, which is one of my favorite movies for sure. So, yeah.
And when I'm a They Live is my favorite Carpenter film, so of course Keith David is like God. You know what I mean? Like, I love that guy, and it always makes me laugh when I like watch these films that like his old films and his genre stuff, and realize that like, my first real true exposure to him growing up was probably Something About Mary. So, you know, I mean, like, and so he's just so brilliant. The guy is just awesome.
Awesome to work with too. He's so great because we had a week. We had him for 7 days, and had to get him in and out. And I was pretty nervous about, like, okay, I think we can do that. And as soon as we started shooting, I mean, it'd be like take two, he'd nail it. Take one, he'd nail it. I'd do a second take, and he'd nail it again. I'd be like, I think we got it. We're gonna be fine.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and back to Keith. You know, still on Keith. We shot. The two sets were built in a warehouse on a lake in January in Ohio, and we had a very, very cold January. It was an unheated warehouse, so we never
got. And you did that on purpose in homage to The Thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so.
Well, when Keith would say, I'm a little cold, and then I'd be like, well, wasn't The Thing cold? Like.
The guy never batted. He never complained.
He did not complain.
You know. So you literally, we had six space heaters. We tried various heating elements. We had like a butane thing and like a gasoline heater. But
what was it? We had like a jet engine. Someone brought in a jet engine type thing. Well, it was gigantic.
Well, it was powered by butane, and it made the whole cast and crew sick. Yeah. So everyone got like boozy. So like, dude, you can't use this anymore. It's like, well, you're gonna be cold. So, I mean, it was...
And I'd tell everyone, like, don't light a cigarette. Yeah.
We really had to try to, like, we had to warm up sets a lot because we didn't actually want the breaths. We wanted to feel, like, slightly warmer than 45 degrees, but it was so unbelievably cold. And you had to go outside to use, like, the facilities. We rented this,
like...
Portageon thing with a heater, but it was like a lot colder out there.
It was like a movable bathroom.
It was a movable bathroom. And it had a heater, but it didn't work. So you're like going to the restroom and it's 40 degrees. And everyone was just a champion. And Keith never complained one fucking time. So,
in point of fact, he was actually singing a lot of the time. So
that's awesome.
See, and that's so cool because with using Keith David, like you mentioned before, I assumed that it was going to be like this little, like, I pop in, hi, I'm Keith David, and he just keeps walking or something. And then when I saw, like, he was a real character, and he wasn't, and, you know, I don't want to go into how, you know, exactly how long he lasts, but, I mean, he's an actual part of the film, not just this, this quick, you know, like, day-long, you know, pop in that gets his name on the front of the DVD, but... I thought that was great because it also, it kind of normalized him because you're like, oh shit, Keith David. Then he gets so wrapped up in the story and with everyone else, he just gels immediately and he seems like he's just another one of these people in that room. And so yeah. I thought that was really, that was a great use of bringing in a bigger name with you know, the rest of the cast. So yeah, no, hats off to you guys for that because I watch a lot of low budget stuff and. I don't know how often you see names like, you know, the James, you know, the Tom Sizemores and the
Eric Roberts,
you know.
Michael Madsen.
Michael Madsen, yeah, that whole, like, that pay grade that just kind of pops in everywhere and does voiceover for you know, an opening narration. So I thought, man, hats off to these guys. They actually used the talent they paid for.
That was the idea. Tom Sizemore is one of the great actors, I swear to God. But just since you mentioned Sizemore, I think he can still do something amazing. I'm dying to work with Tom Sizemore. Yeah.
And it's in him. You watch him even in these ultra low budget movies. You know, he's in bad werewolf movies. You know, three of them come out a week with him. But but he's still good. He makes those bad lines seem believable. He kind of, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I guess Hollywood's unforgiving but I think he's one of those guys we do eventually go back and we go through all these performances and say, okay, yeah, he is one of the greats.
I know. He really is. Oh, my God.
You know, he just needs a good piece of writing. You know,
yeah.
This guy just needs a good script, I guess.
Or I don't have anything for him, but I want to have it.
Our mutual friend of Blaine and I, mutual friends, actually, run a podcast called Eric Roberts is the Fucking Man. And they literally are watching. They go through two Eric Roberts films or television appearances in each episode, and which means they'll sure. never finish because he's got, like, I think by the time every time they do a new episode, he has more projects announced. It's like, we did two last week, and now he's got three new ones. And,
that is fucking hilarious.
And it's hilarious. It is hilarious. And like, the crazy thing about it, it's just like Sizemore. Like, he comes in a lot of these movies where he does. They obviously have him for one day, you know. He comes in, he does his stuff, he leaves, and he might even put in a pretty good performance, but it's in a horrible movie half the time.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, a lot of people don't know how to get a lot out of their talent. And you guys definitely did with Keith David, and, you know, obviously, you know, just like they shoot horses, don't they? I mean, you were similarly budgeted, same size stars, you know? I mean, it worked out really well.
Why would it kill for $4.3 million in any time?
In today's money, much less in 1969 money. Wow.
Yeah.
But I mean, so, I'll take Keith David over Jane Fonda any day. I'm sorry.
Well, Keith really gives a shit. I mean, honestly, right. he was not at any point in time that it. I mean, he was like, he was really into the character. He had a lot of questions. We talked a lot about it. I mean, he was not just like, I'll show up and do it. Like, he was really into it.
It wasn't for the paycheck.
Not at all. Because it wasn't that much money. I mean,
you're right.
It really wasn't. He was like, I'm, you know, he really believed in it. So.
That's awesome. And it's great to have a professional who can come in and show everybody else how to be a professional, too. You know, I mean, not that your other people weren't pros, because you had some other folks who had some experience, but
that was Flip Rossovich on our first movie.
And I got a question for you guys. By any chance, did you get him to tell any Rudy Ray Moore stories? because he's in like every club scene in Avenging Disco Godfather.
He never mentioned that.
He did not.
No. I always
he
loved
it. He talked a lot, but he never mentioned that.
Yeah. He's like, if you look in the background of like every scene in that movie, you'll see Keith David just kind of wandering around mixing drinks.
And really, Rudy Ray, so the Dolemite guy, is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. That's what we're talking about. Yeah.
He never brought that up.
I wish I would have asked him now.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Well, since he's gonna be a key member of your cast moving forward, so
I've got like 100 thing questions I still want to ask him, and I like
right.
because I was the, you know, we had to go to that place, and you know,
right, and of course I had to go right too. So what was it like working with Roddy Piper, man?
Exactly. Between takes, I wanted to do that. Like so when you and Kurt Russell are,
yeah, exactly. Oh. So awesome.
I would have many Chuck Norris questions with, what was it, Braddock, Missing in Action 3?
Is he in Mission? He's in that?
Yeah. That was the first. That's how I always remember him, because when I was a kid, I loved the shit out of those movies. And
yeah.
He's in part 3 of Missing in Action.
I know 1 and 2. I don't know 3 that well. Okay.
I know 2 well.
So it looks like we might be launching a side podcast called Keith David is the Fucking Man.
But, there you go.
I'll talk.
Or Tom Sizemore. I feel like we got our pick right now. But
so much Mr. Rogers to talk about, though.
Oh, jeez. That's so true. But so, just going back to the film, I know that we talked a little bit about the layout and the structure of the film. The games that they play, they start out not as intense and get more intense, obviously, as they go. And I don't want to give away a ton about the games, but Blaine brought up one of them. And Blaine, you said you had a question about that, even though we already kind of addressed it a little bit.
Oh, yeah, he already addressed it. I was kind of laughing. I just wanted to bring up just with some of the mystery. Eventually, I guess off
it's not there, much of a spoiler to say they play Twister.
Yeah, because that's what I walked away with, that it was Twister.
That will be, I mean, like, to elaborate on it a little bit, the idea was that we, that we leave one game completely to your imagination. That as we're getting, because that game follows right after, we're talking about game six. There's seven games. That's right. The second last one. And game five is where we really go there and get gory. And
it's probably the only game where it gets pretty damn graphic.
Yeah, exactly. So that we were just constantly trying to keep the mystery alive, and that after going there, I don't know, we're being difficult, I guess. But, that we would then go completely in the opposite direction. You have no idea, but you know it's not good.
Right. Exactly. And like I mentioned before, I do think that kind of skipping through that one, it does help the pacing, even beyond the mystery. It's like, getting into these games, you're like, okay, at that point, everyone's kind of curious to see how this is panning out. So I think that's kind of a cool way to keep the movie moving at that at that same kind of velocity, and also, you know, leaving something to the, you know, because I mean, all the disgusting shit I've been imagining that it was, you know, whatever it was. But I do think that it does help kind of as you're getting to that final buildup. I think it works.
Yeah,
it's like you said too before, is that sometimes the you can't depict on screen the horrible things that are going on in my mind. It's actually worse in my mind than especially without that $4.3 million, you couldn't have come up with the things going on in my mind. I promise you.
Because, if we had $4.3 million, we still might have done it exactly the same way,
which is awesome because the aftermath of it that people will see and the reactions of the players that are still there. And all that, you know that really horrible stuff happened. You know, really, really horrible stuff. That's all you know.
Well, yeah, no, it's like, so if you've got a bunch of, you know, we've all seen characters playing games in movies. We've seen these movies. So imagine that the characters that are, you know, these guys that are running the games have been doing it for 20 or 30 years. So after 20 or 30 years, you get kind of bored. And you have to come up with ideas, and we've got the go-to game that it's a crowd pleaser, but you got to kind of throw new games into the mix to make it interesting. Maybe some of them are interesting, and that was kind of an idea that we talked about. It's like, oh shit, like, you know, like what's the final Jeopardy? You've done it like 1,000 times, so.
Yeah, that for sure, because when there's that one scene in the back room with Seth and Mike, with the Lion and Cody, and that says, to tell you the truth, we're kind of running out of ideas, which I had more of. There was more of that going on in the script. That they're kind of like, you know, like, oh, we'll just play the board game tonight. I don't know.
They're burnout status.
Yeah, burnout status.
Well, and you know, it's pretty cool to see that. The Lion is a pretty awesome character because he's a horrible, sadistic bastard who you can't help but love.
You can't help but love him. That's exactly right, dude.
he's so likable the whole time, especially when you see him every time he enters, and it's like it kind of gives off that same kind of like gladiatorial vibe that we saw in They Shoot Horses, and like he just comes in, and it's just like this whole like bread and circus kind of thing where he's just doing his like his little dances through the room, and I love how you just set up kind of, you know, the stuff that's, you know, later used, you know, on the covers and things like that with a lot of the promo material that you know, you got that slow motion dance in that mask, and it pumps up the audience as well. As you know, and you just see everybody just going nuts in the crowd, and that just plays really. It adds a fun level to, you know, some pretty dark shit.
You know, one of the great but wild days is, you know, making a deal with the devil. And I've always felt that if you were to make that deal, you would be a hell of a charming bastard. You would make that deal. So the friendliness of Blondie and the Lion in the picture, you know, you're not going to do crazy stuff if you're not being charmed into it. It makes a lot more sense to be wooed than to be, you know, I don't know what the other sense of it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, so much of that stuff is what Seth brought to it, too. I mean, he's there was stuff in the script that said the lion does a little dance down the aisle, and that's what Seth did. It's like, okay, so he brought someone to it, and really more, I mean, going back to They Shoot Horses, Don't They, where Big Young's character is never not detestable in it. I mean, he's on a certain level. I mean, he's got this whole shticky showman-y thing, but you never like Gig Young in that movie.
He's sleazy from the door. I agree.
And then even though the lion character, like you said, like the lion character is doing worse things in our movie, some of that was in the script, but Seth brought so much to it. It just made him likable.
Sure.
Right. I mean, just got that charm.
Yeah, and with his charm, it also reminds you that nobody's here by gunpoint. Everybody showed up. They were given, he gave them that choice. So I think that kind of plays to where in They Shoot Horses, it feels more like they're being held hostage than even in your film, where everybody shows up and he makes that clear. And I think that kind of adds to that charm. It's like, hey, buddy, I'm trying to help you out.
Right, and actually, even though the folks don't come out with quite as much bank comparably in yours as they would when you compare it to the amount of, you know, but I mean, still a lot. It's a lot of money.
Right.
They actually come out with that money, though. You know, when you look at depression thing, that was one of the other most detestable things about the guy is he said, oh, well, if you win, you get your money minus, you know, your expenses. And then your expenses, and then he hands the girl a bill. Yeah, he hands her a bill. Oh, here's your doctor bills, and your this bills, and your that bills. They're coming out with no money.
Right, but only if you win, is what he's like.
Right. Oh yeah, I'm nice. If you don't win, I'm not going to make you pay.
Well, right.
Yeah. What does he say? That's only if you win. I'm not a crook.
I'm not trying to cheat anybody.
Yeah, that's what he says.
Oh man.
Yeah. And that was so, you know, Gig Young playing the villain or the non-villain. What I love about great horror pictures are the coda of the villain. That at the end of the picture or throughout it, hey, oh my God, he went back on his word. I love the honesty of great villains. Where like mm-hmm. he's, what he's going to do is how the story's going
to
play out.
There's a total honor thing to the lion.
To evilness.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that was a big thing too for us that they were there by choice, which they are in They Shoot Horses, Don't They too. But I mean, they're not. It's not. We can make all kind of modern comparisons to the Great Depression.
Sure.
But it's not, and they're, you know, they don't. None of the characters in our movie have to be there, and that was a really thing that affected us because it was different than you know. Saw or something like that.
And something about the lion was more compelling than most of the contestants too. I like him. You know, I didn't, it's not that I didn't grow to care about some of the contestants on your film.
Yeah.
I cared about them a little, but he's just so much more enigmatic and fun. And
yeah.
I run a room for him, and I don't know what that says about me.
It's called the Pat Sajak effect.
There you go. Well, Pat Sajak's the man. Another guy I could maybe, you know, write a whole podcast about. No,
there you go. The Pat Sajak, Tom Sizemore podcast.
Yeah, you know, man. They should host something. No, they're not. Pat Sajak's not alive anymore, is he?
Hmm?
What's that?
Is Pat Sajak alive?
Oh, hell yeah.
He still hosts.
Mike never misses Wheel of Fortune. No, I'm kidding.
Still hosts? Man, I'm out. Oh yeah, I know. I'm going crazy. I just read his Twitter the other day.
Yeah, I was about to say he's got a crazy right wing Twitter, man.
I remember that now that I say that. So maybe he should host a podcast with Tom Sizemore. That'd be great. But so as to not reveal much more about your film because I want people to check it out. I appreciate the influence a lot. It was really great for you to pick a film we hadn't seen yet because we were really excited to see that. One of the things we do with our podcast, when it makes sense, is Blaine and I are both weirdos in a lot of ways, but we're weirdos in that we're both actually Christians. We both believe in Jesus and all that good stuff, and yet we both like sleazy dark films quite a bit, and that's one of the things we explore, is kind of just the greater themes as far as like spirituality and humanity and all that crap. So in all seriousness, both of these films, Don't Shoot Horses and yours, deal a lot with that, really, when you think about it. They deal a lot with people having to go against what they really believe in order to achieve a goal that in both of them is driven by a desperation for money. And it's an interesting look at, in my mind, the idea of the authentic, human self versus, that drug, that greed, that whatever, that's driving them. And that's kind of just something that stood out to me in both films.
Wow. That's great. I mean, our movie starts at a church.
So, you're right, it does.
You kind of hit it there, dude. I think looking is a really, really key word there. I think looking and trying to seek out some greater truth that you may or may not know, feels like something that maybe we should explore. And I think maybe we didn't speak of that when Nick and I were writing the picture together, but that looking and that exploring of, and like you said, faith and trying to find some greater meaning, is there's a lot of worth there. Hopefully people take some sort of nugget from, Union Furnace when they watch the picture. But I mean, I think you're correct.
Yeah, I hope there's a lot going on a deeper level in that movie. And there's a total way to look at the movie that way. There's actually a biblical verse about, the lion shall come and offer. I forget the line, and I forget where it is in the Bible, but it's in the Bible.
That's awesome.
So yeah. I didn't know it. Someone told me that while we were shooting.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, what is it? Where is it? And I need to look it up.
Well, I'm gonna probably try to look that up before I get this podcast up, so I can put it in the show notes, because that's pretty awesome.
Do it. Please do. there's a lot. Hopefully there's a lot more to take away from the film than that's a great time, a great thriller, but there's a lot more to take away from it.
And one of the things that you pointed out and we've talked about several times is that for those folks listening who are into the idea of watching, something darker, exploitive, trashy even, but without being really trashy. That's the cool thing about your film, right? Is that you have one scene really, really that goes there. And outside of that, a lot of the really dark stuff, like I said, that happens off screen or is insinuated. And I think that that's interesting because there's not a lot of films that do that, especially in today's day and age. If somebody's interested in this kind of film, but not sure they can watch some of that gorier, grimier stuff, they actually might be able to watch this and really get out of it what you can get out of it. You know what I mean? And I think that maybe that's a good recommendation on this, is that you go there without going there. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, oh,
that's great.
No, that's pretty dead on. I mean, I think people, it's not a safe picture. I mean,
Justin, you're kind of underselling it a little bit.
There's a scene.
It's pretty funny. No, there's a lot of fucked up stuff leading up to that scene.
There's a lot of fucked up stuff. But what I mean is, as compared to a lot of the other stuff that we cover sometimes here,
right,
Blaine. A lot of the stuff that we watch in this podcast sometimes, it's not as... it goes there with only... And I think that's what makes some of the stuff effective, too, is the fact that it only goes there once or twice.
Sure.
Physically on the screen. Trust me, I'm not saying it's a safe film. By any means.
Thank you.
By any means. So, if you're idea of a horror film that kind of, you know, scares you is Conjuring. No, fuck you. Don't watch this movie. But but if you're interested in stuff that's a little bit more on the exploitation grindhouse realm, but you're still kind of inching in, this might be a good picture to watch. It still feels really grimy and sleazy. I'm not going to lie. It's a trashy film, but I like that. So, you know. Well,
What I love about great horror films is earned horror. I love when the horror is earned in the story. You know, like, oh my God, there's a payoff for the horrific moment and stuff. And I love exploitation. I love that shit too. But like, I love when it's like, oh shit, these people went through all this shit, and the horror earns the shit that they put themselves through. You know, like, I love that. You know, there's a lot of great movies that do that.
And it's been really interesting with everyone actually. A lot of people have seen the movie now that it's out on DVD and Blu-ray and stuff. And the reaction has been so different in terms of people going, oh my God, I can't ever watch that movie again. It was so, it freaked me out so much. And then other people are like, oh, you know, I wish it was gorier.
Right.
So it's been across the board of, you know, every possible reaction to, like, it's...
Yeah.
It's well, right. Stupid. And when I say things are not, you know, you go there without going there, I mean, so did Tobe Hooper with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He went there without going there, and that's one of the sleaziest movies of all time.
Hell yeah. One of the best movies of all time.
And yet, it doesn't... It's great, though.
Up there.
But it doesn't show nearly as much as you think it does. When you actually watch it, you go, oh, shit, a lot of this happened in my fucking head. You know
what
I mean?
That's kind of
one of the brilliant things about that film. And I think that you do some of that, too, and I appreciate that. So.
Well, I mean, the image of Leatherface with the chainsaw is much greater than, you know, cutting a limb off. I mean, that's more terrifying.
It is.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up here, one of the things we do at the end is we typically make some recommendations for folks on stuff that they can check out. Besides, obviously, one of the endorsements would be check out Union Furnace. And before I even go to those recommendations that we would want to make, where can people check out your film?
Well, two places. So we have it on Vimeo. So they go to Vimeo on demand.
$2.99 to rent.
Yeah, it's like $10 to own. And you can also buy it on DVD and Blu-ray through our website, which is
MetropolePix.com.
Sure.
And we'll make sure we put the link up for all those who are looking at the show notes right now. So
great.
Awesome stuff, guys. And Blaine, as we're getting ready to roll, did you you have a recommendation for the folks besides Union Furnace who are listening?
Oh yeah, actually, this edit point right there. I actually do have one. I kind of wanted to carry along this what people will do kind of motif, and just wanted to highlight from just a few years ago, 2012's Nothing Bad Can Happen, released by Alamo Drafthouse. Yeah, it's rough. It's soul crushing. It's kind.
If you can't hear, I keep sighing because that movie was it crushed my soul.
I don't know that movie at all, actually.
Yeah, it is absolutely probably one of the most soul crushing movies of all time. Basically, you follow a young kid who's kind of it's based in Germany, and he's coming up. He's clearly just kind of found religion. He's coming from a shitty place in the world, and comes across the guy who's seemingly going to help him. From there, in order for him to kind of earn his keep around the house, he starts pushing him to break taboos and eventually try to betray any kind of sense of humanity as well as his belief system. And I just think it's kind of a fun, not a fun, that's a
really no, terrible way to try it. There's nothing fun. For this film.
It's a great, I think it wouldn't be a bad pairing with this movie that you'd actually be able to, you know, see kind of another side of it as well, what someone will do just to keep their pride and prove their own humanity. So that's my pick for the week. And you can, like I said, it can be found on Blu-ray through Drafthouse Films. And I'm pretty sure it's on Amazon Prime as well.
Right, right, and it's a few different places. I think Shudder's got it right now too. It's a great film. It is a soul crushing film, and I actually hope that we can talk about it on this podcast at some point. But oh man, it's a rough one. But that said, I'm gonna go a little lighter, although still dark. I mentioned it briefly before, but it kept coming in my mind just because of the tropes that I think, like we said, started probably with They Shoot Horses, Don't They? But I fucking love the movie Cheap Thrills. A couple years old now.
Pat Healy.
Yeah. Pat Healy, Ethan Embry, David Koechner. It's fucking hilarious and dark as shit. And I love it for that. So if you're looking for something that's a little bit more fun, and actually fun, not misused word fun, it's actually it's a lot of fun. I mean, it really is. But it is also really, really rough in parts. And it's definitely... an interesting film about what people will do when they're desperate as well.
Well, all right.
I actually have not seen Cheap Thrills either.
Really?
I haven't. No, and like some of like the Furnace reviews that people showed me were like, oh, it's like, you know, like it stands alongside Cheap Thrills and these
other Saw, things. Which I've only seen once, but Nick has never seen.
I've never seen Saw either. I've seen a lot of movies. It sounds like I haven't seen.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Wait, those are interesting comparisons. Saw and Cheap Thrills, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see the influence. I mean, not influence, but the similarities. Yeah.
And I saw Would You Rather fall into that conversation with the reviews as well. Which I'm going to go. Okay, I'm going to go on record and say this movie is so much better than Cheap Thrills.
All right, you want to hear a funny story?
Yes.
So Katie Keene, who plays number 6 in this film, the young woman in the movie, she texted me like a week ago, and she's like, "Nick, have you ever seen Would You Rather?" And I was like, I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. I heard of it the first time when it was, again, in like a Furnace review, and they were like comparing them.
Right.
And she goes, oh my God, it's a lot like Furnace, kind of, but Furnace is so much better. This is the worst movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, the only reason I checked it out was that was when Sasha Gray was trying to cross over into mainstream filmmaking. Right. So I was like, she was great in The Girlfriend Experience. I was like, I'll watch this little like 10-cent horror movie, and it's everybody, and it's got a lot of good like genre names in it, and it's bad. It's just bad writing.
That's what she said.
Fucking lame.
Yeah.
Well, I have not seen it, and with that resounding review, I think I might just.
I know.
Hey, well, guys, thanks so much for chit-chatting about your movie and just all this other random fun stuff. We appreciate having you on.
It's been a blast. And,
yeah, keep us in mind when you got more stuff coming out. We want to be big supporters because we dig what you're doing.
Sure, oh, man. Thanks, man.
Anytime, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you guys so much. I guess we're going to head out of here. Just to remind everybody, make sure that you are also subscribing to the Farsighted Network. This week we will have a new episode of Misspent Matinee with myself and my ex-wife's new husband, Chris. We're going to be covering RoboCop and top 5 films of 1987. So if you want to hear how weird our fucked up modern family is, make sure that you subscribe there as well. And we will see you folks next time. Peace.